This is White Sox Weekly, your all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing and a drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago.
Now, here's your host, Jeff Mellor.
Happy Saturday. Hope you're having a fantastic weekend as the fall is quickly approaching. And it's going to be a temperature check here today on White Sox Weekly, 312-332-3776. Going to ask you your confidence level of the White Sox making the playoffs after they have been in a bit of a gully lately here. It has not been ideal as the White Sox have lost a season high tying 4 straight games and 9 of their last 12. That is the glass half empty approach. The glass half full would be the White Sox are still in first place in the American League Central. They have been so for 91 straight days. Correct that. Not 91 straight days. 91 days this season. They have been in first place every day since the 4th of July. And they're currently still a half game up on the Cleveland Guardians. More importantly, they are one up in the loss column. And the White Sox also lead the Houston Astros by a half game. Now, that one is a little bit more dicey because the Astros hold the tiebreaker over the White Sox. But we're keeping an eye on that because the number 2 seed is very much in play. And with the number 2 seed comes a bye in the first round of the playoffs. You do not have to participate in the wild card round if you're the 2 seed, which is what the White Sox are trying to accomplish with a Central Division win. And if they can hold serve against the Astros here down the stretch. So we'll get you caught up. As I noted, the White Sox have now lost 4 straight in a row. That is the season tying mark for them. Last night in St. Louis, game was delayed an hour and 10 minutes due to some potential rain that never came. And so we got things started at 8:25 last night. And Chase Meidroth was champing at the bit to get going. He was ready to play some baseball.
He's ready to work, and the first pitch of the ball game is swung on and hit in the air. Deep left center, way back there, and it is gone. Leadoff homer. First pitch of the night for Chase Meidroth.
Unfortunately, it was going to be a short-lived lead. I was amused because one of the notes I made in the pregame yesterday, I said, look, keep an eye out. Ivan Herrera, the Cardinals DH, leads baseball in terms of hit by pitches. He actually has more than Sam Antonacci, believe it or not, if it even seems possible. And Anthony Kay, who leads all of baseball in hit batsmen, was on the mound for the White Sox. So my what to look for last night during the pregame show was, hey, it would certainly stand to reason that you've got the guy who's been beaned the most going up against the guy who beans the most. Keep an eye out for that potential matchup. And sure enough, it didn't take long. First inning.
The 2-2 pitch. Down and in, and he hit him. So Anthony Kay, who's hit the most batters, hits the batter who's been hit the most times. 24th hit by pitch for Kay, and the 29th time Herrera's been plunked.
Now, that would prove to be costly because Alec Burleson, one of the top run producers in all of baseball, is the Cardinals' cleanup hitter, and he made Anthony Kay pay for that hit batter.
Short lead by Herrera. 1-0 pitch is lined into the right field corner. That's going to get to the wall. Keep an eye on Herrera. They're going to send him around third. Meidroth relay to the plate. Late. And we're tied at 1.
So the game was all tied up at 1 apiece, and the Cardinals just kept adding on throughout the game. In the second inning, Mason Winn with Leo Bernal aboard.
1-0 is chopped to third. They're going to throw to second. One, throw to the plate, and Rogers can't handle the bounce throw by Mydroth, and a run scores. They almost had a shot at a unique double play. Bernal initially froze. Colson fired to Mydroth. They got the force at second, but he bounced the throw to Rogers, and it was in plenty of time. Bernal never even slid. So it's 2-1 St. Louis.
So that was unfortunate because the White Sox certainly had, as you heard Lennon on the call, the opportunity to turn the unorthodox double play, and they failed to do so. Chase Mydroth, though, he was a man who wanted this one last night, and in his second at bat, he wasted very little time tying things up.
The lefty coming back, swinging a fly ball, left field, deep again, gone into the bullpen. He's tied the game at two apiece.
But the Cardinals would add another in the third inning as Joshua Baez, who has had a nice little run after debuting with three straight home runs at Wrigley Field in his big league debut, the first ever player to do so. He added an RBI single in the third.
There's a swing and a base hit out in the left center. Walker had to make sure that liner went through. He's going to be sent. Doyle's throw to the plate looks pretty good, and it's just off the mark. Just to the right of home plate. Walker scores. And the Cardinals lead again, 3-2.
So the Cardinals took advantage of Anthony Kay last night, and perhaps more frustrating for the White Sox was the fact that they failed to come through in some opportunities with plenty of runners on base. Now, Tristan Peters did not start yesterday's game, but he came on to pinch hit in the fifth inning after Brenton Doyle had taken the first two at-bats, and after the Cardinals had loaded the bases, Tristan Peters came on after the lefty Matthew Liberatore was relieved. And with the righty on the mound, Will Venable chose to go with Tristan Peters to pinch hit. And with the bases loaded, unfortunately, as good of a season as it has been for Peters, last night was not his night.
Well, Graceffo's ready. Here it comes. Swing and a miss. Strike three on a low slider, and he gets out of it with no damage at all. Sox leave him loaded. Bottom of the fifth.
Big moment in the ball game there. And the Cardinals would quickly make the White Sox pay. Alec Burleson again after driving in one early, drove in another last night.
The 2-2 lined into center, a base hit. The Cardinals will add to their lead. Walker will come around to score. Burleson with his second RBI and his 106th of the year makes it 4-2.
106, by the way, is second in all of baseball behind only Sal Stewart, who has 107. Joshua Baez also added his second RBI of the game off of a double.
The pitch hit in the air toward the corner and left. That is trouble, and it is off the wall. Burleson around third. Acuna will not make a relay throw. It's a double for Baez. It's now 5-2 St. Louis.
Leo Bernal, the catcher, would add on even more.
Leo Bernal with a base hit the other way out in the left. Baez is going to score. And now 6-2.
So at that point, it certainly felt like the White Sox were up against it. However, that was in the bottom of the fifth. After the White Sox had loaded the bases in the top of the fifth, failing to score, the White Sox, sure enough, loaded the bases in the top of the sixth. This time, Randall Grichuk at the plate with only one out and an opportunity to bring home some runs and cut that lead.
The 0-2 pitch. Here it comes. Swing and a miss, strike three on a changeup.
Now, that was tough, and I'll make note here. I referenced this on our postgame show last night. Jay Cuda, who is a fantastic follow on Twitter, if you're a White Sox fan, Jay Cuda had an unbelievable stat that he tweeted out prior to last night's game, which relates to that situation I just played for you there. Cuda yesterday, in the White Sox last 50 opportunities for a sac fly, and that is runners on third with less than two outs. So obviously a fly ball brings home that run in most normal situations. The White Sox, in their last 50 opportunities prior to last night, they have one sac fly. one for 50 in that situation. And then last night, Grichik in the same position strikes out. I mean, if you want to ask yourself the question, why have the White Sox struggled a bit here recently? That stat is one that is completely alarming. And also, you know, a lot of people are frustrated with the White Sox lack of ability with runners in scoring position. And I get it. Like, but that stat sometimes, you know, there can still be two outs, runners in scoring position. That's not always the easiest thing to bring home. However, in sac fly situations, when you're one for your last 50 prior to last night, and then last night you strike out with the bases loaded and one out, that if the White Sox fail to hold on to this lead that they currently have, and we end up looking back, that is a stat that is going to be glaring when all is said and done. Miguel Vargas followed up Randall Grichik, who had just struck out, and unfortunately, Vargas just missed tying the game up with two outs in the top of the sixth and the bases loaded.
The pitch. Swing and a high fly ball out into left center. It's deep. It's back there. And it's caught right up against the fence. Church got right to the fence and made the play, and the Sox do not score.
Yeah, so Miguel Vargas gave it a ride, but about a couple feet short as he just missed a game-tying grand slam in the top of the sixth. And that would prove to be the big opportunity missed for the White Sox. Leo Bernal in the seventh.
The pitch. Bernal lines past the diving Maidraw. Base hit to left. Here comes the throw by Grichik. Baez scores 7-2 St. Louis.
7-2, and Munetaka Murakami would come on to pinch hit. He was given the night off last night, but he did pinch hit in the eighth inning, and with a runner aboard, he was able to bring home a third run for the White Sox.
And a swing and a bouncer to the first baseman. Burleson throws to second. They do get Teal. Not a good throw, dug out by Wynn. It'll be an RBI fielder's choice. It's 7-3 as Antonacci scores.
And that ultimately is how the game would finish. 7-3. Cardinals beat the White Sox. White Sox now 75-72. A half game up on the Guardians as they entered play today. One up in the loss column. The Guardians are 75-73. The Guardians are underway right now in Minnesota. They won last night 5-2 in their series opener, and they're up early 1-0 in the bottom of the second in the second game of that series. Will Venable talked about a rough night last night.
To be honest, the vibe in the clubhouse is really good. The meetings are good. I feel like what these guys are bringing to the clubhouse and to the field every day as far as energy and intent is right, and it just hasn't worked out the last couple. So continue to go to work. Obviously, there's things that, you know, we all need to clean up, and we'll go to work and do that. But, you know, I don't think that there's, you know, the stress of our situation is compiling on the guys. I feel like we have a really good attitude right now.
As you kind of pre-end about maybe shorter leashes for starters, was that present here tonight, or was that more about, you know, okay, I think you had one swing and miss, just not looking to command of the hitters overall?
Yeah, today going into it, you know, you're kind of thinking, you know, five innings there, you know, with where Kay's been at in the last couple, kind of running out of gas there in the fourth and fifth inning, you're kind of thinking, all right, we get through five with Kay and Richards, and if the spot comes up for the third time through with those righties up, that was the time that we were going to move on and go ahead and go Richards. And obviously that didn't work out, but that was the calculus going into the day. Yeah, just the one big hit, you know. I mean, you got to give our offense credit here, as we've had a number of opportunities the last few games, specifically with the bases loaded, you know, even with less than two outs, a couple of them with two outs. We're doing some really good things to get in those spots, but just not getting that big hit that we need. And I thought today Vargas, you know, crushes that ball to the wall and make a good play. Braden, you know, crosses the ball to the wall and make a good play. So, you know, we're not feeling sorry for ourselves at all, but I think there's some underlying things offensively that are going well. We're just not getting that big hit to cash in.
You mentioned moves you felt didn't work out, but I think the ones letting a Grichuk hit against a righty when you normally, when you had Benny and Mooney available? Were there other things you were kind of thinking of?
Yeah, so that one, you know, as you're looking and evaluating that matchup, you know, certainly that's a move that we've done. As you're looking at the card, which there's a narrow gap between those guys with that, with where Grich is at, you know, I want to trust in him and believe in him so much to give you a chance there. And, you know, later on in the game, the calculus changes that that gap was bigger in the matchup. So, you know, that was one in which we believe in Grich and thought he was the right guy for the spot.
More of a pitcher type matchup than being a changeup guy.
Yeah, and there's a lot of factors involved as you're looking at, you know, pinch hit penalties and kind of things that, quickly narrow the gap between Grich and Benny or Grich and Mooney there.
Will Venable last night after the loss. Anthony Kay, the starter on the evening who took the loss. Kay now 9-9 on the season, talked about his performance.
I feel like they hit some pretty good pitches, so just got to go back to it and see, you know, what we could have done differently.
We were asking you a lot, everyone a lot lately, the team, you know, with you guys in this pennant race. Do you see everyone pretty much the same as to what got you to this point? No, like, you know, the pressure affecting you guys at all?
Yeah, I don't think any of that is affecting us. I think everyone knows what's ahead of us, and, you know, we still have control of our own destiny and got to, you know, keep chipping away each day and, you know, just keep playing our style of baseball.
Well, you mentioned that they did some good pitches. It seems like they're aggressive early in the count against you. What were you guys seeing the approach against you overall?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It was just kind of, I just hit a couple pitches out of the zone. I kind of fell behind a little bit, and a couple balls bounced the wrong way. And, you know, I think some things could have been a little bit different, but I mean, at the end of the day, it was three runs, and, you know, we got to do a better job of, you know, preventing that from happening.
I think talking to guys like today, it's just, it's like the lead in the division has gone down, but in terms of, like, final 15 games to still be in first place and have an opportunity to see, you have to focus on, you know, the opportunity you have more than, you know, the lead that's been, the margin that's been lost a little bit.
I mean, I think if you told us in the beginning of the year that with 15 games left in the year, you would have a division lead, I think everyone in this clubhouse would have signed up for it. So I think, you know, we're just going to keep taking it day by day and keep grinding it out.
I will give Anthony credit. I think that's exactly the way you're going to have to look at this situation. Again, I gave you the numbers. The White Sox have lost 4 in a row and 9 of their last 12. And so it certainly feels like the walls are caving in on you here. But the reality is what he just said. They right now have their destiny in their own hands. So take care of business and you'll be fine. And I think most White Sox fans would agree, if you were honest with yourself, in March, right around spring training when the White Sox were getting ready to break camp, if I had given you this scenario, you absolutely would have signed up for it. Now, it feels a little bit different because of the way they've gotten here right now, but the truth is that they have still played good enough baseball to win 75 games, and it's going to have to be better baseball from here on out if they're actually going to, you know, achieve their goal of getting to the playoffs and winning the American League Central. And here's hoping that it begins today with Sean Newcomb, who will be opening for Luis Castillo today. So Sean Newcomb, a first time, and Luis Castillo will be serving as a bulk role today, not starting for the White Sox. Now, he did that a little bit in Seattle. He wasn't a huge fan of it, but at the same time, I don't think the White Sox have been huge fans of the way that Luis Castillo has been performing. So they're trying to find the best path, a different avenue to victory today, and it will start with Sean Newcomb opening for the White Sox. Sox fans, join us at the ballpark on September 17th as the White Sox take on the Detroit Tigers at 6:40. One of the most iconic looks in White Sox history returns to honor Tim Anderson's retirement from Major League Baseball. Don't miss the return of the South Side, presented by United. To purchase tickets and prepaid parking, visit whitesox.com/promos. So that's the question, Sox fans. What is your confidence level right now here on September 12th in the White Sox making the playoffs? Feel free, scale of 1 to 10, give me a call. Aiden, you feel like you're caught up? You're firmly ready to go? Aiden O'Connor, who had to take a mental health day yesterday from White Sox baseball, which I certainly understand. So we had to catch him up on what was going down last night, what he missed. I don't think the result was what he was looking for, but nevertheless, I figured we would catch him up. There was some good news for the White Sox last night. I'll share that with you next when we come back. This is White Sox Weekly on the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Follow Chicago's Home for Sports on Instagram at ESPN_Chicago.
Playoffs.
Better guy to get it than Caminero. And there's a drive. High and deep to left. That baby gone. And the Rays have clinched a playoff spot. Number 40 for Junior Caminero. And what a way to clinch it. And who else? But Junior.
Last night, big home run in Tampa by Junior Caminero to walk it off, a walk-off winner, which clinched a playoff berth for the Tampa Bay Rays. They became the first team to clinch a spot in postseason play this year. Now, the Milwaukee Brewers would become the second team shortly thereafter last night. With a 20-0 shutout of the Reds, by the way. That was an interesting scoreline. But, yeah, the Rays with Junior Caminero doing what he does, hitting monster home runs, his 40th dong of the season. He is now in the lead by 2 on Yordan Alvarez. The Astros slugging designated hitter was actually out of the lineup last night as he deals with an ankle injury. He hasn't been placed on the IL, but what this does mean, in addition to the Rays clinching the playoff berth and the Astros suffering a loss, which is good for the White Sox because, as I noted at the outset, they are trying to secure that number 2 seed, which the Astros are the closest competitor, I guess, along with the Guardians, who are both are a half game back of the White Sox right now. But the Astros hold the tiebreaker over the White Sox. So if they finish tied, the Astros would be the number 2 seed, which is why the White Sox need to ultimately stay a game in front of Houston by the end of the season, in addition to finishing in front of the Guardians. I will note that the Guardians, who have just been tied up by the Twins, by the way, Emmanuel Rodriguez with a solo home run in the bottom of the third to tie that game up at 1 apiece. So thank you very much, Minnesota. We are all Twin City fans here in Chicago this weekend. So they've tied that game up. But back to the Astros and Rays last night. Caminero now has 40 home runs. Yordan Alvarez, who missed the game last night, has 38. So the pursuit of the triple crown looks like it could be waning here in the final couple weeks of the season because, yeah, Alvarez 2 homers behind. He's also clinging to a batting average lead of 4 percentage points over Chandler Simpson. Alvarez right now hitting .310. Simpson, another Ray, hitting .306 right now. So that gap has closed considerably from where it was at earlier in the season when Alvarez was hitting somewhere in the neighborhood of .330, .340 a little bit after the All-Star break. And then RBI. Alvarez right now has fallen behind Pete Alonso in that department. Alonso, the polar bear, has 97 for the Orioles as he has really come on in the second half of the season for Baltimore, kind of propelling them back into the playoff race ever so slightly. And Alvarez is now sitting at 96, so he's an RBI behind Alonso. And it gets tricky because you can always, it felt at the halfway point at the All-Star break, like Alvarez, it was going to be, you know, persona non grata that he was going to walk away with the triple crown. But now, as you see, he has fallen in 2 categories. And honestly, it feels like it's probably going to just slip out of his grasp, especially if he's dealing with an ankle injury that keeps him out of the lineup when the Astros are fighting for the division themselves and that bye. So obviously this could hamper him and his chances down the stretch here. Let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Sports radio station.
Hey, White Sox fans, secure a 2027 season ticket plan and receive priority access to 2026 postseason ticket opportunities. Be here for all the action this October. To lock in your ticket plan, visit whitesox.com/2027. So yesterday was the 25th anniversary of 9/11, baseball, and the role that it played in helping the country heal is undeniable, and there was a lot of memorable moments, specifically in New York last night as the Yankees and Mets squared off in the Subway Series at Yankee Stadium last night. I'll get you caught up on a little bit of what went down there last night, and also for those of you who might be a little bit younger and may not completely grasp what was going on in the aftermath. I'm sure plenty of people are aware of what happened on 9/11, but the aftermath and how baseball in some ways helped a country heal. I'll take you back to that time a little bit when we come back on White Sox Weekly. This is the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
The Sox on your phone, the ESPN Chicago app.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly. I'm Jeff Meller. Hey, Sox fans, join us at the ballpark for City Connect Fridays. Catch the team in the iconic uniforms every Friday night and shop the full collection at the team store. For more info, head to whitesox.com/city. White Sox getting set for game number 2 of 3 in St. Louis as they are currently on a 6-game road trip. After their series against the Cardinals, the White Sox will head to Cleveland and play 3 games in what will probably go a long way in determining which team ends up winning the American League Central. I have good news, White Sox fans. The Twins right now lead the Guardians 3-1 in the bottom of the third, still threatening with a couple of outs. They've got runners on first and third. So here's hoping the Twins can keep adding on to that 2-run lead that they have right now. And maybe, just maybe, the White Sox can extend their half-game lead right now over the Guardians and push it back to a game and a half after their loss last night and the Guardians win. It would certainly be nice to push it back to a game and a half, which would ensure that no matter what happens on Sunday, the White Sox would head into Cleveland in first place. At the very worst, they would be a half game up on the Guardians heading into that series. Of course, if the White Sox can take just one game in that series, they will clinch the season series from the Guardians. That's important because, remember, baseball did away with 163. They no longer have those tiebreaker games so that they can just start the playoffs immediately. They don't have the ability to, you know, play out an extra day there. So what that means is if the White Sox can win just one of those games, they will secure the season series and the tiebreaker from the Guardians in the event that they finish with the same record at the end of the year. So big series on deck. Of course, got to take care of business today and tomorrow, hopefully, against the Cardinals here. The White Sox will roll with Sean Newcomb as the opener, and then Luis Castillo expected to follow him up in the bulk role. It's the first time he'll do that as a member of the White Sox. Today is September 12th. Of course, I'm sure very much aware that yesterday was the 25th anniversary of 9/11. 9/11, 2001, 25 years ago. And it's hard, I think, to encapsulate what that day was like for so many people, especially if you're maybe in your early 30s or younger. You had, I'm sure, a far different experience as to other people who are already young adults or adults at that age, because no doubt you were probably going to school and had, you know, maybe you were shielded from a lot of what was going on that day, or maybe you're somebody who is, you know, 18 years old right now, 21 years old, and so you only read about it in a history book. But as somebody who was 20 years old on that day and lived through it as a young adult, it was terrifying. I was going to college at Loyola University in Chicago, so I was not in New York, But of course, being in a major city across the United States, it was one of the most terrifying days, you know, 48 hours, 72 hours of my life, because nobody knew what to say and nobody knew what was going to come next. And so from that perspective, it was just unlike anything I had ever experienced at that moment in my life as a 20-year-old. You know, it had been a, in some ways, a fairy tale life-like experience up until that point, living in the United States. And then, of course, the towers were hit and life seemed to change. And of course, the White Sox were actually in New York, scheduled to play the Yankees that day. They ultimately would bus home because air travel was suspended for, I couldn't tell you the exact number of days, but it was definitely three or four, if not longer. And they were very sparse after that for a while. And so the White Sox bussed home when they were scheduled to play the Yankees that day. And of course, the entire city of New York had to deal with the aftermath of that. And so what's interesting, and I don't want to trivialize in any way the impact of what happened that day, the tragedy. And so please don't misconstrue what I'm going to say. But the importance after baseball and football were canceled, it was really hard to come to grips with when life was going to go back to some sort of normalcy. And eventually, 10 days after 9/11, baseball resumed play in New York. And the Mets played the Braves that day. And I'm going to read for you a statement by Ken Meifert, who is the vice president of sponsorship and development of the Hall of Fame, because he wrote a really great piece. And this is how it goes. Baseball returns to New York. For many of us, 9/11 is a moment forever etched in our memories and onto our hearts. The events of that day left us with a tremendous sense of loss and anger for what had been taken from us, and a heavy feeling that our lives would be changed forever. As America mourned in the wake of the attacks, Commissioner Bud Selig suspended all MLB games across the country. 10 days later, baseball helped a broken world together again. On September 21st, professional sports resumed in New York. The city was still shaken, mourning, and coming to grips with a changed world, but that game represented a flicker of hope and return to normalcy. It gave people faith that despite our terrible loss, America was going to persevere. That evening at Shea Stadium, the game reached an unforgettable crescendo in the eighth inning when Hall of Famer Mike Piazza of the New York Mets hit a dramatic go-ahead home run to lift the Mets to a 3-2 victory. In that moment, the stadium erupted, not just with cheers and jumping, but with tears and embraces, uniting everyone in a moment of healing unlike any other. So that is from the Vice President of Sponsorship and Development at the Hall of Fame, Ken Meifert. And he goes on to talk about the 9/11 memorial and the special items that they have at the Hall of Fame to commemorate that game and what it meant to the city of New York. And I'll play for you just a couple of things that I thought were really well done yesterday. So Mike Piazza sat down with MLB Network. The Braves played the Mets in that first game in New York 10 days later. And those two teams were huge rivals. Not that they aren't, but they were constantly competing for the NL East. And Mike Piazza sat down to reminisce about that game. You'll also hear the voice of John Smoltz to begin. You'll hear a little bit of Mets manager Bobby Valentine, and then also Mike Francesa and Chris Russo, Mike and the Mad Dog, who were the biggest sports talk show in New York during 2001. So I thought this was really well done. Mike Piazza on that moment hitting a home run in the aftermath of 9/11, 10 days later, and how emotional it was. I think it starts with John Smoltz right here.
John Smoltz, the closer these days, gets set for Atlanta.
A one-run ball game. Atlanta has the lead. But with this guy hitting, that's subject to change.
I was in the bullpen, getting ready, stretching. I think I might have even been throwing, and Piazza was up.
And here's the man the Mets want up in this spot, down a run late in the game.
I actually was thinking to ambush him, which means to hit the first pitch.
So you're looking, you know he loves his heater. You're looking
at
the
heater. Yeah, I do. I'm looking right down the middle, and I'm like, if he puts it there, I'm going to ambush it.
And the first pitch to Piazza instead of throw to first.
I think when he threw over, he took me out of my zone just a little and put me to sleep.
Here's the pitch. Fastball strike to Piazza right down the middle.
And then I just locked up, and then I just froze.
Met fans are standing here at Shea, hoping they might see a long ball here.
Lopez wants it away. And it's hit deep to left center. Andrew Jones on the run. This one has a chance. Home run by Piazza. And the Mets lead 3-2.
Wow.
We want to be dramatic. Oh, let's be dramatic. You know, those Mets, yeah, Mike's home run. That was the most captivating moment in my lifetime.
Shea Stadium is going crazy.
You and I have been in buildings. We've seen a lot of big home runs. We've seen walk-off home runs.
That's the biggest home run we ever saw.
It was the biggest home run by far.
So that was Francesa and Chris Russo at the end there, who obviously know New York sports, talking about it was the biggest home run they had ever seen in their lives because of the moments that we were living through back on 9/11/2001 and 10 days later when the Mets would go on to beat the Braves in comeback fashion with that Mike Piazza home run. Now, Bobby Valentine was on Get Up yesterday, and you heard him talk about how that was the most dramatic moment of his life in that clip. He added a little more context yesterday on Get Up. This is Bobby Valentine remembering Mike Piazza's home run.
No one wanted to play. You know, the fear was real. And it was something that no one ever experienced before. So the idea of even playing in New York was a foreign idea. People were saying why. The players were wondering why. And when we got to the stadium and there were metal detectors and there were dogs sniffing our lockers and there were uniform personnel all over the stadium, including up on the rooftop, it was a different feeling. Somehow the courageous players from the Atlanta Braves, the New York Mets, went out on that field, embraced before the game, and played a really crisp game of baseball before almost a full house. And then the superhero came to the plate with the team behind and hit this home run. And not only was the sound of the bat different than I had ever heard, but the roar of the crowd was different than anything I ever heard. It changed things. And, you know, what Herm and his guys did and what all the people in sports did to try to turn those frowns upside down was a script that was written in heaven, without a doubt.
I think one of the points that Bobby Valentine brought up there, how the players were afraid to go out into the field, that, you know, he's not being hyperbolic. Like, people were truly wondering what you could do without being fearful. And so for professional Major League Baseball players to go out and onto the field when I'll be honest, people were legitimately concerned. They were putting their life in danger by going to a full stadium that was going to have the first, you know, in front of 54,000 people, I believe, the first actual sporting event that took place in New York. Everybody was on pins and needles. Like, could you move forward with your life without being fearful? And for that game to happen, and that's why you hear Mike and the Mad Dog say that was the biggest home run they've ever seen hit. And I don't think that really is being hyperbolic about the moment. So yesterday, the Yankees and Mets played at Yankee Stadium, and they had a ceremony, a very emotional ceremony prior to the game. A couple of first pitches thrown by a married couple who both lost their fathers in 9/11. The couple, they were both 10 years old when their fathers died in the tragedy. They threw out the first pitch yesterday between the Mets and Yankees. And it just, it really did matter that baseball helped heal the country. So just wanted to play some of that for you in case you happen to be a little bit younger and just wondering, you know, maybe you missed the significance of what was going on shortly thereafter. So I was hoping to bring a little bit of that to you there with some of that remembering by Bobby Valentine, Mike Piazza, and some others there. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. When we come back, the White Sox had themselves a little bit of a dust up earlier this week at Wrigley Field. We'll talk about that when Sam Antonacci gets under the opponent's skins. We'll do that right here on the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Captain Jay Hood, weekday morning, 6 to 9, ESPN Chicago.
Swinging a ground ball to third. Picked up by Triolo, and they'll get one. Relay to first in time. 5-4-3, exactly what Ramirez wanted. And the White Sox get only one. And now we've got some action. Sam Antonacci. And the benches are clearing. Both benches have cleared, and they're gathering behind the mound. Antonacci upset with one of their infielders. And here come the relievers out of the respective bullpens.
I believe it was Connor Griffin and Antonacci.
Sam is really upset. Justin Jersey is holding him back from the pile.
So that was Wednesday night. Welcome to the jungle that is Wrigley Field. Antonacci, Sam, in an attempt to break up a double play on the relay, he, I suppose, extended his elbow out towards Brandon Lau. It was ultimately Brandon Lau, the Pirates' second baseman. And Lau completed the double play. And that led to questions about Sam Antonacci and whether or not he is a dirty player and whether or not that behavior on the field is acceptable. Antonacci was asked about his slide in the post game into seconds as he was trying to break up the double play.
Yeah, I went into the base pretty hard, just, you know, trying to make a harder throw for him to have to make. And, you know, a completely legal play if you, you know, go look at the rule book or go look at what happened. You know, you can slide as late as you want as long as you keep contact with the bag, and that's exactly what happened. And I think nowadays in this game, this age, I think a lot of people are used to, you know, just letting up on that play. You know, they say, oh, you know, we play 162 games, you know, just I'll let up early. I don't want to make contact with them. But, you know, here we're trying to get a run any way we can. And that's a close ball game. These are playoff games. And all I'm trying to do is scratch around there. And, yeah, I'm sure he's a great guy, but you know, he had a few choice words to say at the end, and then kind of you know, walked away after that. And yeah, when you have a problem and you walk away like that, that's I'm happy enough to have a conversation, but you can't walk away. And you know, he's a grown man.
I don't understand anybody who would be overly upset with Sam Antonacci playing hard. He explained to you exactly what he was doing. Maybe there was issue taken because the elbow was extended in the groin area. I don't know. I mean, honestly, I don't think Antonacci thought twice about trying to, you know, target the family jewels, as I was asked about it on Waddle and Sylvie yesterday. The truth is, I think he was just trying to break up the double play, and it happened that Lau converged near him in that spot. I don't think he was trying to be dirty in that regard. I think Lau probably took more exception with the fact that most players don't do that in this modern day in baseball. And you heard Antonacci explain why he plays hard, and I think most White Sox fans appreciate that, right? You never know what run could be the difference in a ball game. And so if you can break up a double play, maybe the next batter hits a home run and it's a two-run homer. And I believe the White Sox lost that game 2-0, if I'm not mistaken, if memory serves. So, you know, you just never know what could be the difference in the ball game. And I think that's exactly what Sam Antonacci is trying to do. Here's the truth of it. He didn't break up the double play. Had the runner been safe at first, the Pirates certainly could have used a challenge to appeal whether or not it was obstruction, but they did not have to because it didn't break up the double play. But had it, the Pirates had that ability to challenge, and potentially if they wanted to review it, he could have been deemed obstructing, and then the runner could have been out at first place. And finally, he hasn't been disciplined by the league for his play. So I think it's all in the rule book right there. Anybody who is upset with it, I don't know what to tell you. This is a hard-nosed, gritty baseball player just trying to help his team win a ball game. I can't believe there was as much outrage about it as there actually was when there was minimal contact on the play. So that's my two cents on that one, folks. Hey, Sox fans, be at Rate Field Friday, September 18th, as the White Sox take on the Tigers at 6:40. Then stick around after the game for a post-game concert featuring Cole Swindell, presented by Xfinity. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/concert. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. When we come back, we'll let you hear from White Sox Director of Player Development, Paul Janish, who met with the media on Thursday. White Sox have had 15 rookies make their big league debuts this year. That leads all of baseball, and they are in first place with all those rookies. So Paul Janish, perfect opportunity to let you hear what he had to say. This is White Sox Weekly on the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
The ESPN Chicago Triple Play, AM, FM, HD, and app.
Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly with you. Join us at the ballpark Saturday, September 19th, for Sox Crawl halfway to St. Paddy's Day, presented by Miller Lite. Enjoy an exclusive pregame crawl inside the stadium. Plus, receive an Irish quarter zip presented by Miller Lite and special Sox Crawl hat. Fans must be 21 years and older to attend. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/soxcrawl. So, the White Sox, their minor league affiliate, the High A Winston-Salem Dash, have advanced to the championship round of the Southern League. They will take on the Greensboro Grasshoppers. Their series, it's a best of three. Their series starts tomorrow, Sunday afternoon, 1 o'clock Central Time. And then they will play games. That game is in Winston-Salem. And then they will go on the road for the final two games on Tuesday and Wednesday in Greensboro to play the Grasshoppers at their stadium. Those games will be at 5:30 on Tuesday and 5:30 on Wednesday. That is where Paul Janish, who is the White Sox Director of Player Development, began his conversation with the media on Thursday.
Just really exciting. Obviously, any of the minor league teams making the playoffs is always a big deal. Birmingham still has a chance as well. They're getting back with a few games left to play this week. But what Winston's done all year has been great. The way that team started, obviously, with Bonner, Shelton, Zepino, we take those guys from them, and they just kind of keep playing them all year long. And the best term that comes to mind is just resiliency. Game one the other night was a really good example of that. They get down six runs, they score five runs in the fifth, and were down 3 runs in the ninth inning. They hit a big 3-run homer to tie the game and win the 10th. So just kind of a microcosm of their season. But I give Guillermo Quiroz and the staff there just like so much credit, because I think we're going to look back in a couple of years. A lot of the players that played in Winston this year, and, you know, in particular some of the position players, I think we're going to have the opportunity to play in Chicago at some point or somewhere in the big leagues. And, it's just hard to understate kind of the foundation that is being set there this year.
You mentioned Caleb Bonner. How has he exceeded expectations? And I know he suggested his center field or outfield. Yeah, how has he done that?
You know, obviously he's hit a bunch of homers this year. He's had a really good year. Again, I've said this before and I'll say it again. You know, he went through his hurts a little, what we'll call like a little semi-slump earlier in the year, and he managed to get himself out of it and has proceeded to have a really good year in Double-A. And the transition to the outfield's been really smooth. I mean, he was totally bought in. No pushback whatsoever, and I just, you know, the selling point there is not that he's never going to play on the dirt by any means. It's just, you know, we all see how our major league team, the roster is being utilized, and so it's really just an effort to give him the best opportunity to be ready to do whatever may be asked. And I don't think I'm speaking out of turn here when I say that we feel from an offensive standpoint, his bat's going to get him to the big leagues, you know, probably sooner than later, hopefully. And he was great. He's a team player. You know, despite the fact that he may not always be as vocal and, you know, amongst maybe like an interview atmosphere, but, you know, when you see him in a locker room, in a clubhouse, you know, in the dugout amongst his teammates, he, again, really good teammate, obviously really talented player, and, yeah, I mean, he's done what he's supposed to do this year.
Will you guys suggest that he play mostly outfield when he's there?
In the Fall League, yeah. That was one of the reasons that, you know, we thought it was important for him to go to the Fall League. Yeah, he will. Not to say he won't play any infield there, but the priority is for sure to play the outfield. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's just exclusively outfield there, you know, depending on what's going on. But yeah, the point of him going there is to continue to get exposure to play in the outfield for sure.
At AAA, you have a number of guys that might potentially be on the pitching side.
Yeah, so the biggest thing with Drew, obviously, coming off the injury is just the fact that he's consistently throwing, recovering, going back out there and doing it again, right? He has pitched well his last few times out. So for all intents and purposes, he's in a really good spot. But yeah, I would just highlight kind of like the macro view of the guys that are in Charlotte. It's all hands on deck from here on out, right? Depending on what happens on a given day at the major league level, like any of those guys, you know, especially the 40-man roster guys, they need to have their mind right to mentally be able to come here and help this team win a game, get the opportunity to present itself.
Does that take the form of starts, or could it be being prepared for multi-inning relief outings, or anything on the sun?
100%. I think that it's probably that role potentially here is going to be dictated based on like what potentially happens and, you know, the opportunity to present itself. But you think about like a Noah Schultz or a David Sandlin, they're obviously starting in Charlotte, but if the opportunity presents itself and they come here, it's very reasonable, as we've seen, that, you know, they would pitch in a bulk role. I potentially start as well, but, like, you know, the bulk option is definitely going to be something that they're aware of and they're ready for. And I think that, again, highlighting how the major league team has used the staff all year long, I don't think any of those guys are going to be caught off guard by that.
Yeah, what I stood up to about both Noah and David, since they've been back on
the Andrew. Yeah, so Sandlin's been locked in. He's had, you know, whatever, 4 or 5 really good ones in a row, and the integrity of the stuff's been really good. He's feel comfortable saying he's probably as confident in the places he's been in a little while. And Noah the same. You know, he gets called up earlier this year for the first time. You know, obviously he pitched well and struggled at times. He's been back down to Charlotte. He's, for all intents and purposes, has been back in the zone. You know, I say this a lot about the guys transitioning to the big leagues. I think this is just part of his transition to the big leagues. I think knowing Noah the way that we do, mentally and physically, he's going to be in as good a spot to come contribute if and when the opportunity presents.
Hagan will get his first career start here tonight. Just, you talk about transition to the big leagues. What do you make of his transition and how he's contributed to his team?
Yeah, it's a hard thing to put your finger on, but Hagan obviously is a very talented guy. Yeah, taken very high in the draft, had a very storied college career. The last couple years, the first half of the season has kind of been, marred a little bit by a little bit of an injury. Nothing serious, but in the second half of both last year and then now what looks like this year, he's come back after the injury and been really good the second half of the season. So
kind of what he's doing right now doesn't surprise me. Both knowing Hagen, the makeup, and then obviously the ability is unique, and so not surprised by it. I'm excited for him. You know, I say a lot, like, when these guys get here, you know, we get to know them and we love them, and we try to do the best we can to get them ready for them. But at the end of the day, like, getting here is just something that most, until you do it, guys got to make the adjustment once they get here. So just, I would just share that, like, our group on the PD side is just really excited for what he's done up to this point.
You have among the best baseball currency in the game right now in young players. We've been told for decades that currency can all be used at the major league level. Would you say that, you know, there is plenty to look at and make sure that you observe your players properly before you trade them for other good young players?
Yeah, I think it's completely fair to say, and I think that's, you know, one of our jobs, and probably me specifically, is to make sure we're doing a good job on the PD side of what you said, knowing our players, right? And that means, it may mean between the lines, and it may mean outside the lines, right? So, but having a really good idea of who they are and what they are, and, you know, what we think they can become. But, you know, at the end of the day, when you start talking about trades, and especially, you know, high prospect type guys, right? There's, if you're gonna get value back, you're gonna have to get something up in most cases. And yeah, so we just try to provide Chris with as much information as he needs to be able to make good decisions relative to some of that stuff. But as we've all seen, like, whether you're talking about our system or another one, you know, a guy being a really good prospect doesn't always translate into being a really good major league player, and that can be a difficult thing to assess at times. But yeah, to your point, to answer the original question, I think that's part of our job, is to know our players better than anybody else does.
Most teams that debut 15 rookies aren't contending for a division title. What does that say about the job that Will's done this year?
Yeah, you know, Will's so approachable, right? And we speak a lot. I know he talks to Chad Bender a lot. And we talk a lot about, again, sharing the information about who the players are, what they're good at, you know. And him and his staff, I think, have done such a good job of putting players in a position to succeed as frequently as you can, understanding, like, the major league level is very difficult. And it's just, there's a lot more exposure and the lights are a little brighter. So I just think you have to give him and his staff a ton of credit. And all that to say, I also think you got to give credit to the players, because at the end of the day, they're the ones that go out on the field and execute. And I think we'll tell you the same thing. But from a communication standpoint, I think he does such a good job of making players comfortable as much as you can for the first time at the major league level. And I think what we've seen on the field this year is very indicative of that.
As far as Thorpe is concerned, is it still a discussion whether he's ready, or is he ready and just whether the team needs to bring him?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think from a health standpoint, physical standpoint, I think he's where he needs to be. So I think at this point, it is going to be, you know, a little bit more based on major league need and whatnot. And again, he's had good outings. He's recovered for all intents and purposes as well. But I think we're doing our diligence. We need to exercise caution too, because at the end of the day, he's coming back from a significant surgery. Again, had the goofy appendix thing early in the year that just put a big speed bump in the whole deal. But everything that we've asked him to do up to this point, he's done and responded well. And so hopefully that'll continue to be the case.
When you have a organization player like Ed Nunch, and he has some of the characteristics of the old-time baseball players combined with new baseball players, how far does that go in the organization? Is that an example for the other young players? How do you perceive all that?
Yeah, the term I use for Sam is contagious. Like, that's what he is. He was like that on our side in the minor leagues. You know, every team he played on, you know, you can say what you want, he has an edge to him, right? He plays the game hard. I don't care what era you're playing in, he was going to be good at this game. And so, yeah, I 100% think he's an identity guy. And that's how we referred to him, you know, before he got to the big leagues. I don't think we're ever going to see him again. So that's how I'll refer to him at the major league level. And I think it's not just Sam, but I think this team as a whole has really taken on an identity that's pretty special. And I think Sam's a big part of that. They play the game hard, and, you know, they don't. And Sam specifically, I'll speak to. Like, I don't think he spends a whole lot of time worrying about making friends, which, you know, you got to respect.
What's kind of the path forward for Shane Smith? He's working on it a little bit right now.
see if it's going right back to try to start, you know, in the offseason, in the spring, and try to see if there's a, you know, kind of fit with what he's doing right now.
Yeah, I think, you know, we haven't talked extensively about next season with him specifically, but I do believe that he will go back into the starting role and attempt to fill one of those rotation spots moving forward. But like you mentioned, at this point, he's pitching out of the pen in Charlotte. He actually got the save last night. He's pitching as well as he has for an extended period of time up to this point. Obviously, the shorter length outings, but he seems to be in a really good spot physically and mentally. And he's in the same spot. Like if and when the time presents itself, opportunity or need, I guess at the major league level, he's doing everything he can do. He's ready as he can be.
What do you? What's kind of your read on what the debut season of Billy Carlson is? You know, he hasn't gotten to play a ton given the injuries and, you know, the surface level stats would say he's not killing the ball, but maybe the other good stats maybe suggest there's more power and contact there than maybe he needs to.
Yeah, no, and I would feel very comfortable saying Billy's first full season was success on the field. To your point, he dealt with some injuries, some of which were, you know, a little out of the ordinary with the skin stuff, but one thing we can take away from this year is just understanding the competitor that Billy is and again, the teammate that Billy is. And, you know, there's context to that, right? Like, I refer to him a little bit as like the loose in the clubhouse, right? Like, he kind of connects everybody, and that means, like, not just American guys, but Latin guys, too, and that's a pretty unique skill set. I do think there's some underlying things that we feel like as a group offensively lends itself to being pretty excited about him down the road. And you can't lose sight of the fact that I don't know if there's ever going to be a team off the Billy John where he's not the shortstop, right? Like, he's got that kind of defensive ability. So, I think, too, like, from a physical standpoint, like, probably his biggest area of development, which is just going to take a year or two, is just adding a little weight, becoming a little bit more durable in a way that gives him the ability to endure the full season.
How do you guys explain the bat speed increase this year by pretty much everybody in the organization, and how does that happen? Can you give us a little clue into that?
Yeah, I've got a good friend named Ryan Fuller who loves to say you get what you focus on. So, like, it's something that we made a priority, and we saw the results of it, which is really encouraging. You know, just pure bat speed doesn't exclusively make a guy a good hitter. I think there's a bunch of components that we try to implement on the hitting side that have contributed to offensive success, especially in player development. And, you know, I should know this, but we had 7 or 8 guys hit 20 homers this year, and that was really, really encouraging. And it's not just Caleb Bonner, right? Like, who we all know is uniquely talented, but it's other guys that, you know, maybe you didn't think were going to do those kinds of things that are doing them, which is, I think, really indicative of a good process. Yeah, just a good kid. You know, all he wants to do is play, and unfortunately he had a little bit of a blip on the radar that, due to the timing of, like, where we were in the season and the amount of time left, it just didn't make any sense to push on it. But the impression is just really good. He's just, again, guy's guy. He's a teammate. He loves being in the clubhouse. Even though he didn't get to play a ton, he did get out to the affiliate, so he knows what it looks like. We don't just show up at 7 o'clock to play the game, right? You get to see what that looks like on a day-to-day basis, defensively and offensively. And I think that's going to serve him well next year, despite the fact that he didn't get to play a ton.
We were talking the other day that he's not going to the AFL, but is he kind of doing baseball activities or kind of participating in the professional league even after the rest of the
season? He's going
to
be present. You know, he's not going to do a ton, if I'm being honest, relative to baseball activities. He's taking ground balls and stuff. So what I should say, he's not going to do a ton offensively. He is he's doing defensive work and, you know, whatnot. But at this point, we've kind of made it a point to say, look, let's just get him as ready as he can be for next spring training. And a lot of that's going to have to do with the offseason program, both offensively, defensively, in the weight room. And again, we love Rock, and we're really excited about him. He's never played full season before, so even though he's a college guy and a little bit older, he's going to have to get used to what that means and looks like. And we'll just try to give him, you know, the best opportunity to do that.
That, again, was Paul Janisch earlier this week, the White Sox Director of Player Development. Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly. Obviously, one of the key members that Paul Janisch was talking about inside the White Sox organization, Caleb Bonnemer, had another big night last night. He also met with the media this week. I'll let you hear from him when we come back right here on the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
White Sox Weekly Saturdays on ESPN Chicago.
2-0 pitch, and that's flying high in the air to deep left field. Gariola is back, and so is this baseball. Home run, Caleb Bonnemer into the party area, back of the Knoxville bullpen. It is 3-1 now, Smokies.
That was Caleb Bonnemer hitting his 37th home run last night for AA Birmingham, the Barons. And Caleb Bonnemer made his 9th start in center field as well last night for Birmingham. Bonnemer slashing .250, .379 with a .554 slug, 29 doubles, 37 home runs, as I just mentioned, across two levels, 92 RBI, 100 runs scored. He has 82 walks over 130 games between Birmingham and Class High A Winston-Salem. Those 37 homers, by the way, they're tied for fourth in all of minor league baseball. Those are the most by a Sox minor leaguer since Rondell Rollin hit 39 back in 1987. So most home runs in the minors in 49 years. Not too shabby for the 20-year-old Caleb Bonnemer, who we're going to let you hear from in just a moment on the transition to center field. White Sox fans, families eat free. Grab your family and head to the ballpark with a family pack. Starting at $21, each family member gets one hot dog, a drink, chips, and a cookie. For tickets, visit whitesox.com/family. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. So this was Caleb Bonnemer talking about the transition to center field.
It's been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed it. And yeah, I think as I've been getting more reps and more games, I've definitely starting to get more comfortable out there. But yeah, I mean, all the work that I've put in with Doug Sisson has been great. And yeah, I've been having a blast.
Different than you expected? And if so, how so?
The first few games, it was kind of, it was a whole different experience for me. Like I've literally never played outfield pretty much my whole life growing up. So it was kind of just interesting to see the game in a whole new perspective. But honestly, as I've been playing out here for a few weeks, I feel like I've kind of gotten used to it now. But yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of little things, just like communicating with the other outfielders, like cutoffs and all that little stuff. There's probably some of the stuff that needs, I guess, just more time to get used to.
Hey, Caleb, congrats on the monthly honor. Just how would you kind of describe your August at the plate and just your continued development as a hitter?
Yeah. I feel August, obviously a good month. I mean, I don't really know the numbers off the top of my head, but I feel like definitely after the All-Star break, yeah, I kind of hit a stride there for a few weeks, for a couple months. But yeah, honestly, just kind of trying to build off the adjustments I made just throughout the whole season, and just trying to repeat those every day. That's pretty much it. Just trying to keep my routine and keep making adjustments every day. Then luckily I was able to put up some good numbers.
Yeah, you mentioned adjustments. Just overall, what does it mean to be able to see some of those adjustments that you have made lead to success, particularly making the jump to AA?
Yeah, it definitely gives me a lot of confidence that the things that I've been working on are definitely working. There's still other things that I'd still like to get better at, but for the most part, definitely from High A to AA, the adjustments I made mechanically and approach wise, they definitely worked, and I'm definitely happy with how that went.
Hey, Caleb, I just want to ask you, you mentioned the confidence you've gotten from the season, but as you come down the stretch here and kind of look at the totality of 2026, well, what have you learned about yourself as a player? I mean, for people on the outside looking in, they can see the raw power numbers and your appearance in the futures game and how you've accelerated through the system, but what have you learned about yourself as a player as you get closer to your dream of being a big leaguer?
I've put up a lot of power numbers this year, which I'm definitely happy with. I do think I hope that I can continue to improve on, I guess, like the hit tool, kind of get the batting average up a little bit, maybe less strikeouts. That would be something that I would like to improve on. But yeah, I mean, honestly, overall, I think, yeah, this season's been great for me. I mean, playing in the outfield, that's big for, I guess, just my career in general. And yeah, like I said before, just kind of making adjustments, here and there. And I think that's kind of what the minor leagues is all about, is kind of learning who you are, learning how to make adjustments. And yeah, I think this season is in totality has helped me, kind of do a lot of those things.
Have you been motivated by the success in Chicago that they've had and knowing that you're not that far away?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's definitely cool to see that. But yeah, like I said before, I kind of just try to focus on where I'm at. And then, yeah, whenever they see fit to call me up, whenever that may be, that's up to them. But if I just keep focused on my routine every day, playing good ball every day, hopefully that'll take care of itself. But yeah, it's definitely, it's cool to watch the big league club play how they are. And they're in a playoff race. So, yeah, hopefully they can pull it out.
Markin?
Caleb, I know you said when you moved to the outfield, you were obviously still doing your infield work, and Josh Barfield stressed that it was going to be both. I mean, do you have a preference to one right now? And is it exciting to know you'll get more work, you know, starting soon in the fall league as well?
Yeah. I mean, whatever helps the club is good with me. But yeah, I mean, I will say I've had a lot of fun playing in the outfield. I mean, I still enjoy playing in the infield too. But yeah, I think, yeah, overall, I think I could have played a little bit better infield this year. So yeah, I think just having both tools in my bag is a great thing for me. So yeah, I'm thankful for just, yeah, the opportunity to play both.
What's going on, Caleb? I know you, building off that a little bit, I know you've played more shortstop in the past. When you have played infield the past 2 months, it's been primarily third. How do you feel like you've kind of been able to adjust and get used to more of the reads at third compared to short?
Yeah, it's been coming along. Yeah, like I said, I think if I could take a step up defensively in the infield, that would be good. But yeah, I mean, I think just the more reps at third, the more comfortable I'll get and I've been getting. But yeah, I think, yeah, just same thing with the outfield, just more reps, more games there. But yeah, I mean, I still, yeah, I mean, growing up, I played short my whole life. So, getting some reps at third is definitely good.
Yeah. On the offensive side, since you've been in Birmingham, one thing you talked about a little bit was trying to use the opposite field more. I know your opposite field is up like 7% since getting the double compared to when you were in Winston. How do you feel like that change has been, and just getting used to, you know, working the other way a little bit more often?
Yeah, I think for me, kind of using the opposite field or going the other way, when I do it, it's kind of the term I use is kind of like an accident. I'm like, I don't want to be trying to hit the ball the other way, but if I can have the ability to kind of be late on a fastball and catch it deep and kind of shoot them the other way, I think that's a very big tool for me to be able to have. And kind of like what I said before, if I can kind of increase that hit tool a little bit, maybe hit for a higher batting average a little bit, I think being able to do that, being able to catch heaters a little bit deeper and kind of shoot them the other way would just give me a lot more room for error. So yeah, I think I've gotten a lot better at that in double A. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why I've been having some good success here. But yeah, I think just keep working on that part of my game could be a huge help for me.
Yeah, I guess my question was, as consistent the numbers been, how do you feel like that lull after the initial success at high A maybe expanded your mind a little bit about things you wanted to work on or wanted to build out more rather than obviously, you know, pulling and lifting the ball over the fence a lot this year?
Yeah, I think I've always kind of had a picture in my mind of, I mean, yeah, I'm definitely kind of pull heavy, pull dominant, but I've always wanted to still be able to have that ability to go the other way and catch it deep. And I think, in Winston, or kind of near the end of Winston and early in double A, working with Fuller, working with Sherm, I started to kind of learn how to, I guess, just be able to do that better. making some mechanical adjustments and approach adjustments. And I think there's still a lot of room for improvement on a lot of those things. But I'd say I'm still working on, I'm still working on a lot of things. But I think just a few adjustments we made mechanically and approach wise allowed me to be able to do that.
You know, Fuller often talks about kind of hunting for damage early in the count, and then taking that kind of see it deeper approach with two strikes. How much of, when you talk about going the other way or taking those opportunities to work tops at field, is part of your two strike approach at this point?
For me, one of the adjustments I made was, pretty much like in high A for like almost the first month, I was pretty much just cheating the fastballs pretty much every pitch of every count. That was one of the adjustments I made, was almost playing like the cat and mouse game, thinking along with the pitcher. And that helped me a lot, kind of being able to back the ball up a little bit, not having to cheat every time to a fastball up front. But also, like you said, like doing damage out front. I mean, that's a big part of my game. So still being able to do that, but also having the ability to kind of back it up and kind of fight with two strikes if I have to.
That was Caleb Bonnemer earlier this week. Let's quickly pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Sports radio station.
Jeff Meller back on White Sox Weekly. A big catch by Al Martin, the Twins left fielder, who saves a Guardians extra base hit there. So that was big. The Twins currently lead Cleveland 4-3 in the top of the seventh. So that was big. That was the first out of the inning, hoping that Minnesota can hang on here and obviously give the White Sox a little bit of breathing room going into tonight's game against the Cardinals. White Sox a half game up right now as I speak, with the Guardians playing. And the magic number sits at 14 for the White Sox.
That's a magic number.
But remember, it reduces with every Cleveland loss and White Sox win. So if this result holds and the White Sox win, we'd be down to 12 at the end of the night. And that would feel much better than we felt last night after the White Sox lost their fourth in a row and the Guardians won. So that is where things stand tonight. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. Every Saturday, 2 hours prior to our pregame coverage beginning, we get you White Sox Weekly, where we talk to you about what happened over the course of the week. We recap the previous night's game and, of course, bring you guests from inside the White Sox organization, also those who cover the White Sox, and that is basically what we're planning to do next. Scott Merkin, who covers the White Sox for MLB.com, is set to join me right around 5:15. He took in the White Sox clubhouse today. Will Venable spoke, so we'll pick Scott's brain about where the White Sox are at right now with 15 games remaining in the season. Sox fans, join us at the ballpark for Hispanic Heritage Night on Friday, September 25th. It's the White Sox take on the Rockies at 6:40. 15,000 fans, 21 years and older, will receive a Los White Sox poncho presented by Modelo. Be sure to stay after the game for a post-game fireworks show. To purchase tickets and prepaid parking, visit whitesox.com/promos. All right, when we come back, we'll have Scott Merkin on the other side, and also Aiden O'Connor, a diehard White Sox fan, had to take himself a mental health day yesterday from the White Sox. He is producing White Sox Weekly along with Brendan Riley here with me today and the White Sox game. So we're going to get a temperature check from Aiden, where he's at as a White Sox fan and his confidence in the Sox making the playoffs. Plenty to do here on the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Sox games, all of them, on the ESPN Chicago app.
The Sox are under pressure right now. Half game up on the Guardians. And the Guardians are threatening, runners on first and second, one out in the top of the seventh, but they trail the Twins 4-3 right now. So here's hoping Minnesota can find their way to strand those runners and hold off the Guardians for the White Sox today. Sox fans, pre-gaming made easy. Treat your group to a patio party, 2 hours of all you can eat, plus unlimited beer, wine, and Coca-Cola products. For more information, visit whitesox.com/party areas or call 312-674-1000. Jeff Meller back on White Sox Weekly. Aiden O'Connor, diehard White Sox fan. How are you feeling about your Sox right now?
Jeff, I made it clear. Yesterday was the first game in a very long time, even just this season, where no radio, no TV, no social media, just a day off, because it seems like, you know, we've been just waiting for this pitching staff to do it. And then when they do it, the hitters don't do it. And sometimes you need a day off, and it's a little stressful.
You live and die with your White Sox every day, and when you saw the result, obviously it didn't go the way you wanted. What is your confidence level in the White Sox, first off, winning the AL Central? One to scale of 1 to 10.
Let's go with a 7.
Okay, not bad. And how about then making the playoffs outright, whether it be via wild card or the division? It's got to be higher.
How about an 8?
Okay.
Yeah. So all not right,
but not so overly confident after just a. So you think they're going to win the division, though, Aiden?
Yes.
All right.
And I think it's going to come down to this week in Cleveland.
I think that's probably a good thought. I think that's going to have a huge implication on who wins this division. All right. So when we come back, Scott Merkin, who covers the White Sox for MLB.com, jumps aboard and we'll ask him what he found out from Will Venable today. This is the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Follow ESPN 1000 Chicago on YouTube.
Jeff Meller back on White Sox Weekly, as we always keep you company on Saturday, 2 hours prior to our pregame coverage officially beginning. Tonight, that's a 5:30 pregame on the network. We're going to have, looks like a 6:25 first pitch, as the Cardinals are inducting Albert Pujols and Yadier Molina into the Cardinals Hall of Fame with a pregame ceremony that is currently underway right now. So that's going to push first pitch back probably 10 minutes from what it was originally scheduled for, 6:15. Looks like it's going to be a 6:25 first pitch tonight, which, hey, I'll be honest, I would take after an hour and 10 minute rain delay last night without any rain. I'd happily take just 10 minutes delayed because of a Cardinals pregame ceremony to honor Albert Pujols and Yadier Molina at Busch Stadium, which is where we go right now. Because Scott Merkin of MLB.com is covering the White Sox as he does. He's at Busch Stadium. He took in the White Sox clubhouse earlier today. Merk, congratulations on a Michigan win in regulation today.
That was a, yes, that was, I'm going to need an extra second or so to take it all in, though, you know.
Don't rub salt in the wound for all the Western Michiganites
out there. It was really, I love Western Michigan. That is a really well-coached, good team. They played their butts off last week. Today was just kind of like one of those old-fashioned football games, you know, no fancy offense, no offense to speak of, actually, but you know, great defense is showing them. And I should add that the young man who got the interception to set up the winning touchdown, Jair Hill, mm-hmm. part of the Chi Sox athlete NIL program. So there you go.
How about that? Love it. All right,
there
Mark.
You go. There is a tie-in here, besides me ranting about Michigan.
That's all right. We love your insight, no matter what it happens to be. All right, Mark, so Will Venable decides to go with Sean Newcomb as the opener today. What was his thought process on using Newcomb in front of Luis Castillo in the bulk role?
You know, he didn't really talk about Newcomb. You talked more about the lineup changes, but I mean, they've used Newcomb in that role before, and obviously Castillo has struggled. So I think it's anything just to kind of get him going. I mean, you know, he was a big addition for the Sox at the deadline, not just for this year, but he's under contract again for next year. And they need to, you know, kind of get him right. They need to get him right to help get the team right. They need to get him right to get some depth out of him. So I think it was just kind of a change of pace. But again, we'll talk more about the lineup switch just because of the fact that, Leahy, I guess, you know, they're monitoring his innings, so he's not going too deep into the game. And his last name is H-J-E-R-P-E. I don't know how you pronounce it totally, but I think he follows. So he was kind of aligning, kind of looking at both things going into the game tonight.
Okay, so that's the plan with the lineup. That's why it looks like it does tonight. So I guess the bats have gone silent at a bad time, Merck. Do you think that there's anything in terms of pressure getting to the younger players in terms of your observation? You've been covering the team for a long time. You know, it seems to me, you know, just from what I see when I'm at home inside the clubhouse, I don't feel like the pressure is getting to the team, but perhaps you feel a little bit different. I don't know.
No, you know, Davis Martin pointed that out yesterday that, you know, you are, and Colson too, you walk in and it looks just the same. But again, how is it supposed to look, right? Yeah. I mean, they're a young, energetic team. I don't think you're going to see guys maybe after the game and it's a little quieter, but I don't think you're going to see guys the next day like kicking over tables or getting upset about little things because of what's going on. I'll add this point. Like, I talked to Colson back near the beginning of the year when they, during that 6-13 row, and everyone thought, oh, geez, is this going to be a fourth straight 100-loss season? And, you know, were they, including me, were we all wrong on that? And he talked about how part of the struggles were because there are a lot of guys who, even guys who had played extensively last year, like him or Chase or Kyle, who hadn't played April baseball. So they had to kind of figure it out a little bit and figure out that time of year. And I think it's the same for those guys in twofold now, A, because they've never been in major league playoff before, major playoff contention, and they never played this long into the season before. So I think it's, I don't want to say fatigue because everyone's tired, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone who's played this long, even if you're the Dodgers, who basically start their season on October 1st, you know, you're tired at this point. But I think it might just be adjusting to the life of this. And plus, you know, some of those breaks they were getting aren't working their way right now. In July, the ball Vargas hit last night is probably 10 rows back, and it's a tie ball game, right?
Yep.
Last night, it's caught by Church against the wall, and that's all part of it. There's some luck element involved, too.
How about Munetaka Murakami, who obviously hasn't had nearly the productive second half of the season after returning from injury? Do you think it's anything that he can do, or is this more about the league finding ways to attack him and he needs to make the adjustments?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. Once you see him for a while, that's, you know, it changes and you kind of understand his approach a little more. But I think it's also just sticking to what he knows. You know, I've said this a number of times. He reminds me of Jose Abreu in that, you know, he's very regimented. He's very set on his routine. And most really good players are doing that. You know, whether they're 0-for-20 or 10-for-20, they don't change things around. They know what got them there, and they're not going to suddenly overreact to a little bit. It's more than a little bit of a slump now. It's been since August, really, for Mune. But, you know, they make adjustments. They change, but they don't wholesale flip things around and say, here we go, you know. So I think it's just, you know, adjusting back to adjusting to the league. But just think, I mean, this – I was talking to David Keller and Gene Watson the other day in Houston, and they were saying that I don't think people, including myself, have the scope of how big a star he was in Japan. So he's been here before and done this. And, you know, sometimes you're hitting balls over the fence, you know, five straight games, and sometimes you're going, you know, 80 plate appearances without hitting a home run. It's just kind of how it works sometimes.
Scott Merkin of MLB.com joining me here on White Sox Weekly. Merk, Sam Antonacci caught some flack from the outsiders, I would say, who were a little bit perturbed with the aggressive nature that he went into second base. I personally thought his explanation of what he was doing was extremely eloquent and explained exactly the type of player he is. What were your thoughts? Because you've been covering baseball for over 20 years now.
First of all, I think he's great. You know, he's a great guy to cover. I think he has a very unique perspective, you know, from his explanation we did the other night to before the All-Star break when I was talking about how they had 67 games left, and he laughed because of the whole 6-7 thing. And that kind of shows you his personality. But I think, you know, Brandon Lau also is considered a very high-class, tough veteran who does a lot for, you know, in more of a quieter way. And it seems to me that he took a little bit of umbrage in the elbow coming up right at the end. And maybe that's just part of the slide from Sam. But like you said, Sam explained that. You know, I think James Fegan asked about that in the post game, and Sam talked about that too. So I think it was a lot to do about not nothing, but not much. And it blew over pretty quick, and there was no residual effect the next day. And I think Sam's going to continue playing. It was interesting. He was hit by a pitch last night. Ivan Herrera was hit by a pitch last night. And Anthony Kay hit someone with a pitch last night. All three are the leaders, National League, American League, and pitching. So that's just his style. He does whatever it takes. He was talking about the Heart and Hustle Award he got and trying to explain it. And he's like, I don't know what it is. He goes, I just want to win. Whatever helps me win is what I want to do. And that's pretty much his game.
Last one I got for you, Merck, sure. And then I got to let you go. So with the White Sox here, a game or a half game up right now, Cleveland's right now playing against the Twins. Do you think, obviously, this series coming up against the Guardians is going to be huge? Do you think this young White Sox team has what it takes to make the playoffs?
I think they do. I think they're in good position, even if things don't totally work out in the division. But as Colson said yesterday, they want to win the division because they believe they're the best team in the division. I think the biggest thing they can't do, and they're in a throes of one right now, is you can't go into Cleveland and lose all three. You know, if you lose all three, that changes the whole momentum. Even if you lose the series, you're still in shape to make the playoffs. And, of course, if you win the series and up, you're really, you know, in good shape going in. But I think they still believe, and I think once they get in the playoffs, it's kind of all found money at that point. Maybe that kind of flips the switch to get them back going again.
I tend to agree. Merck, thanks for the time. Appreciate you carving some out for us ahead of the game.
Okay, Jeff, no problem. Take care.
Scott Merkin, again, does great work covering the White Sox for MLB.com, has been doing so for a long time. That, folks, is going to wrap up White Sox Weekly, the September 12th edition for you. But don't go anywhere, because the White Sox pregame show on the network is coming your way at 5:30 with a 6:25 first pitch scheduled in St. Louis. I'm Jeff Meller. Thanks to our guest, Scott Merkin, and the executive producer of White Sox Baseball, Brendan Riley, and diehard White Sox fan, Aiden O'Connor. We're coming back with the pregame show in 3 minutes on the ESPN Chicago Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.